You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Friday, which means it is time for Brunch with Bernie, our hour-long weekly town hall meeting, national town hall meeting, with the guy that I think of as America's senator, although people in Vermont know that he's theirs. And hey, Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Bernie, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Or hello, Senator. Forgive the lack of decorum here.
Bernie is just fine.
Okay, so what's on your mind this week?
Busy time in the Senate. Many people heard, and I was there at the State of the Union. I thought the president gave a strong speech. I thought his proposals were kind of more modest than I would have liked. One proposal that he did make that I was very excited about was the fact that he was, through executive order, going to raise wages for several hundred thousand employees who work for companies that have federal contracts. This is an issue that I and other senators and people in the House have been working on for a number of months. And we said to the president that the federal government should not be entering into contracts where workers are working for companies making $8 or $9 an hour. That's not what the federal government should be doing. And the president rectified that, and that was very important. Second of all, I think it gives us some momentum in terms of raising the national minimum wage for every worker in this country to $10.10 an hour. Of the many crises facing our economy today and the decline of the middle class and more people living in poverty than ever before, one of the reasons for that is that many of the new jobs being created are low-wage jobs and they're part-time jobs. And at the end of the day, even if you're working 40 hours a week and you're making 7 1/4 an hour, you're going nowhere in a hurry. And the likelihood is you're probably falling further and further into debt because you can't pay your rent, you can't pay for your car, you can't pay for health care, and you can't pay for food on those kinds of wages. Also, in terms of raising the minimum wage, one of the issues I think does not get enough attention is that if you have profitable corporations like Walmart or McDonald's or Burger King, et cetera, paying people starvation wages, what ends up happening is those workers are forced to go on Medicaid, they go on food stamps, they go into government affordable housing programs, which are subsidized, obviously, by taxpayers and add to the deficit. So it is beyond my comprehension as to why the federal government should be subsidizing Walmart, which is owned by the wealthiest family in America, because they are paying inadequate wages and forcing their workers to get federal government help. So raising the minimum wage is terribly important. We are continuing the fight for the extension of long-term unemployment benefits. It may well be that a vote is coming up early in the week. Our Republican friends have not supported extending unemployment, long-term unemployment benefits, despite the fact that 1.6 million Americans have now been cut off from those benefits. And one wonders what those families do when that income is not coming in. I just don't know the kinds of levels of desperation that many of them are probably in right now. So from a moral perspective, it seems to me you just don't turn your backs on struggling people who are long-term unemployed. And second of all, from a broader economic point of view, what we know is that when these people have nothing to spend, that will result in less job creation or, in fact, the loss of some jobs. And then economists estimate that by cutting off these long-term unemployment benefits, we're going to lose about 200,000 jobs and 0.2% of our future GDP next year. So that doesn't make a lot of sense from the macro point of view, and it certainly doesn't make sense in terms of how we deal with people who are really struggling. Next week, I think at the end of the week, I will be introducing legislation. I believe it's coming up on Thursday. As chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee, which is the will be the most comprehensive veterans legislation introduced in the Senate in several decades. And it covers many, many of the concerns that we have heard from veterans all across this country and from the veterans organizations. And I'm very proud that this legislation has the support of virtually every veterans organization in America, including the American Legion, the VFW, the DAV, the Vietnam Vets, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and Paralyzed Veterans of America, and you name it, they're behind us. And I won't, you know, give you all of the details of a 400-page bill, but one of the things that it does is that it expands VA eligibility. The VA has a very good healthcare system. For a variety of reasons, a number of veterans are not getting into the system when they should, and we are going to expand their opportunity to access the very good quality healthcare the VA has to offer. I have always believed that dental care is an important and integral part of healthcare. VA has not allowed dental care in the VA except where it's service-connected. This legislation will begin the process of bringing dental care into VA healthcare. The VA does a pretty good job right now in utilizing what we call complementary and alternative medical care in order to deal with a lot of the both psychological and physical problems facing veterans. And that, by that I mean using acupuncture, yoga, meditation, and a variety of other alternative, what we call alternative approaches. This legislation significantly expands those options as well. So it deals with education, it deals with employment, it deals with sexual assault. It's a bill that is very, very comprehensive, and we hope very much that we can get it passed.
That's great. Just along those lines, just one pitch. I broke my back skydiving when I was 21 years old, and the one thing that I found over the years that's really helped incredibly is chiropractic. And that's not covered by a lot of insurance.
Right, right.
And, you know, I realize there's a debate, you know.
No, I don't think there is a debate.
Every time I mention it, I get doctors calling me up going, what, you got all those quacks? It actually helps.
This gets certainly beyond VA healthcare.
Yeah.
There used to be a whole lot of debates on complementary and alternative medical care. What I have been stunned is, you know, you go into military hospitals, Department of Defense hospitals, or VA hospitals, and you say, well, these are pretty conservative institutions. And what you find there is their doctors are very supportive of these alternative procedures, and the veterans themselves and the patients want that. Mm. And one of the problems we face in this country and in the VA is that, especially in terms of pain relief, we do a whole lot of medication and sometimes over-medicate. And what the VA and other researchers are looking at is how do you deal with pain and other problems other than through very heavy medication. And that's where programs like acupuncture and meditation, yoga, et cetera, come in. And the VA and the DOD, by the way, have both been utilizing these procedures with success.
Yeah. We have about 40 seconds till the break, Bernie. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, the other issue is that, you know, I think we're all mindful that while the economy has made progress in the last 5 years from the disaster that it was when Bush left office, it is still in very, very rough shape. And we've got to continue the pressure not just to raise the minimum wage and extend long-term unemployment. We need a serious jobs program to put millions of Americans back to work. Real unemployment, not 6.8%, 13%. Youth unemployment, 20%. African-American youth unemployment, 40%. We have got to create a jobs program, including the rebuilding of our crumbling infrastructure and movement toward energy efficiency. And we can put a whole lot of people back to work doing very, very important and meaningful jobs.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Sanders will be taking your calls for the rest of the hour right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
By the way, be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, and he's got a town hall meeting coming up in Montpelier. You can watch that streaming live on his website. Check it out. And welcome back. Bernie, when is that town hall meeting that you've got?
It's going to be Saturday afternoon at 1 p.m. It's going to be in Montpelier, Vermont, for anyone in Vermont or nearby. But it could also be live streaming it, and people can pick that up at our website, sanders.senate.gov.
Great. And I'll mention that again, you know, later on in the day, too. So
thank you.
So let's pick up some phone calls here. Dave in Albuquerque, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie and Tom. Monday, Bernie, on C-SPAN, you said that you believed in climate change because of what the scientists say.
Yep.
So I also heard that if we switch from regular gas for cars and trucks to natural, clean-burning natural gas, we would save 30% reduction in climate change, carbon footprint. So my question is, would you trade off a 30% reduction in carbon footprint for more fracking?
Well, that's a good question, Dave. And I think the answer, though, is more complicated than that. What I said on television and what I say on this show virtually every week is that the scientific community is almost unanimous in telling us that climate change is real, that it is man-made, that it is causing devastating problems right now, and that those problems will only get worse in years to come. What people, some people believe, and I think, you know, they make a reasonable case, is that natural gas is a reasonable bridge, for the short future, for the short-term future, until we move into less polluting types of energy. My own view is the following. What I think we need to do is move very, very aggressively, and I'm sorry the president didn't get into this in greater length in his State of the Union, toward energy efficiency in terms of making massive improvements in weatherization for buildings all over this country and in homes. What we have seen here in Vermont, and it's true all over the country, is you can cut energy consumption by 50% or more. Through weatherization, and B, through things like heat pumps, geothermal, and other technologies. Number B, I think that in terms of transportation, we have made some progress by improving CAFE standards, but we've got to go even further in terms of electrifying our vehicles and getting much better mileage per gallon. So there's a good debate, Dave, between, you know, moving toward natural gas and the implications of fracking. But I happen to think, I have to tell you, that fracking is a very, very serious, problem.
We have just 30 seconds to the break, Bernie. There, you know, one of the Japanese automakers is introducing a hydrogen-fueled car next year. You can make hydrogen out of water in your garage using electricity from a solar panel.
I mean, yeah, these technologies are exploding. And, you know, there are many of them out there. I just talked to somebody right now who is the head of a utility in Vermont who is pushing heat pumps, mm-hmm. which means that, you know, depending on your circumstances, you can cut your energy bills literally in half with a modest increase in electricity. It's a good trade-off. We have buildings in Vermont all over this country moving aggressively toward geothermal. So there are technologies out there both in transportation and in heating and in cooling, where we're making some real progress.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us, back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. One minute past the hour of the Tom Hartman program. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, and take some more calls here, Bernie?
Sure.
Okay, Judy in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. I love you both. Thank you for everything you do.
Thank you.
I'm calling about publicly financed campaigns, and I have ideas, but when I share them with others, they say I'm completely naive and it could never happen. So I'm interested in your opinion. Because I believe that we'll never get anything done effectively until we get rid of the current plutocracy. So my idea is that no other money can be put towards a campaign for anything, not even the candidate's own money. Only everybody gets the same amount of money from the public. And then, of course, money is not speech, according to the Citizens United debacle. That's it.
Okay,
Judy, thanks very much. And let me just pick up on one point that Judy made, which is enormously important. I know that many of the listeners out there are concerned about the economy and how we address the decline of the middle class and the growing gap between the very rich and everybody else. And they're concerned about how we create jobs, and people are concerned about making sure that college education is affordable, and people are concerned about Social Security and preserving and strengthening Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, and people are concerned about climate change, and on and on and on. But one of the points that Judy made is that we're not going to successfully deal with any of those issues or anything else unless we change the way campaigns are financed in this country. The situation for many years has been very, very bad. Citizens United, which said that that corporations are people, and that billionaires and corporations can pump as much money as they want into the political process, is one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in the history of the United States. It is undermining American democracy. And what it means in the real world is that a handful of billionaires, people like the Koch brothers, who are worth over $70 billion, who are now spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, not only setting up all kinds of conservative think tanks, but putting money directly into the political process, that unless we change that system, what you're going to see is a handful of billionaires controlling the political process in America. That doesn't mean to say they're going to win every election, but it does mean to say that they are going to be able to create a Congress and state legislatures and governors all over this country who are increasingly beholden to their very extreme right-wing points of view. So I agree with Judy that this is an issue that has to be dealt with. So I think there are basically two parts to the two solutions that we have to deal with. Number one, we have to overturn Citizens United through a constitutional amendment. Number two, as Judy indicates, we have to move to publicly funded elections. And, that's a complicated issue because you want to preserve freedom of speech and so forth and so on. But I think we absolutely can do that. And I think we must do that. We must come to a point in this country where people are elected based on their ability, based on their ideas, and not simply based on their willingness to be beholden to billionaires, or in many cases, be billionaires or millionaires themselves. So it is a huge issue, and I'm going to spend a little bit more time on that than I have recently.
Mark in Randolph, Vermont, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Mr. Sanders. I had two quick questions. One, why is it so hard to get military records? I've been trying to get mine for the last 11 years, off and on. And I just contacted Mr. Pippinger, and I've contacted your office, Mr. Reed, at the...
One of the reasons, Mark, on that is there was a fire in St. Louis a number of years ago.
Yeah, but that shouldn't affect mine.
Okay. Well, we'll work with you. If you called up Jeffrey, we will work with you and do our best. We do that all the time.
All right. And the second question is regards the NSA. Was 70% of the budget for the NSA outsourced to mercenaries? It would seem to me no matter what kind of laws anybody puts into place, it will not affect anything done by the NSA because mercenaries are not bound by the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Bill of Rights, or any other thing.
Well, I think you're thinking of people who are contracted out. Is that what you're referring to?
Ed Snowden worked for a company.
What I would say to you, Mark, who lives in Randolph, which is not far from Montpelier, drop into our town meeting that we're doing tomorrow on the NSA, and we have two very, very good keynote speakers who are national authorities on these issues. The issue is, to me, the fact that so many employees are contractors is an important point. But the more important point is, do we feel comfortable when you have government agencies who are filing every telephone call that we are making, who are quite able and presumably do get into the emails that we send, the websites that we visit, who have monitored telephone calls made by presidents of countries and allies of ours, who are just accumulating unbelievable amounts of information about each and every American, 99.9% of whom have nothing to do with terrorism. Furthermore, this is not just a governmental issue. This is a private sector issue. It is a corporate issue. And just as the government is accumulating information, one would be very naive not to believe that with all of the new technology out there, that the corporate world does not assemble an enormous amount of information about our buying habits, our banking habits, what we watch, what we read, et cetera, et cetera. So, all of us, are in agreement that we've got to do everything we can to protect the American people from the very serious danger of terrorism, but I think we can do it. I believe very strongly we can do it without undermining our constitutional rights or our privacy rights.
And that meeting is going to be tomorrow, Saturday, at 1 p.m. in Montpelier. Where's it going to be, Senator?
It's going to be at Montpelier City Hall.
At City Hall, okay, at 1 o'clock. And it'll be streaming live also for people all over the country, all around the world, at sanders.senate.gov, right?
Right.
Okay, you got it. Great. We'll be right back with Brunch with Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And be sure to check it out tomorrow at 1 o'clock Eastern Time to see that town hall meeting on the NSA. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls at our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Paul in Hickory Hills, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello, Tom and Senator Sanders. Sir, I've heard you mention before that the United States is one of, if not the only, country that does not have a right to health care, as opposed to countries, and I think you mentioned Germany specifically.
Right.
I was wondering if you could clarify what you mean by a right to health care.
Well, my own view is that it goes without saying that health care is a basic need. Everybody is going to get sick. Everybody, or virtually everybody at some time in their life is going to need health care. And as a society, our country and other countries have to make a determination. Should your access to health care be based on your income? So if you have a whole lot of money, obviously you can get good doctors, you can go into the best hospitals, you can get all the procedures that you need, and your financial situation will be okay because you have plenty of money. In our country, basically, what health care is about is says if you have money, you're going to get very good health care. If you if you're a working class person and your employer does not provide health care, or whether if you have health insurance that has a large deductible or a copayment, you may not be able to walk into a doctor's office when you're sick. And in some cases, if you have a major medical procedure, an operation, you may go bankrupt. Bankruptcy, health care costs have been one of the major causes of bankruptcy in the country. So to my mind, health care in a democratic, civilized society is a right of all people. If you're a billionaire, you don't have any money at all, that is a right because you're a human being and you have the right, should have the right, to get the health care that you need because you are a human being. Now, that principle more or less exists in virtually every major industrialized country. So if you are in the United Kingdom, if you're in Canada, if you are in most of the European countries, including Germany, if you're in Scandinavia, if you're a citizen of that country, you go to the doctor when you need to get the care that you need to, regardless of your income. Prescription drugs in most cases in those countries are either free or very affordable based on your income. So that is what I mean about health care being a right. In our country, that has not been the principle. And the end result is that we have a very complicated, dysfunctional healthcare system whose outcomes are not particularly good compared to many other countries, and yet we end up spending almost twice as much per person on healthcare, which is why I believe in a Medicare for all single-payer system, which would guarantee healthcare to every man, woman, and child in this country and do it a lot more cost-effectively than the current system.
Susan in Casper, Wyoming, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom, for everything that you do. Mr. Sanders, I was wondering, I'm so frustrated with our mental health care system, and I prefer to call it our brain disease and brain health, but I live in Wyoming, which has the highest suicide rate in the nation, and I just see that since the 60s, we have done away with care for people with brain disease. What we need is nonprofit 30-day psychiatric hospitals around this country where you don't have to be a danger to yourself or others, but when you're spiraling out of control, you can go there for the help that you need. Pills just don't get it. We need human beings how do we get there? I mean,
Well, Susan, thanks very much for the question, and thanks for highlighting what is obviously a crisis, not just in Wyoming, but all over this country, including the state of Vermont. And I think people have seen that crisis tragically in the last few years in terms of these terrible shootings that we've had in schools and shopping malls and elsewhere, with people with serious, serious mental illnesses are just, you know, shooting other people, in some cases taking their own lives. You know, in a sense, Susan, your question ties right into the question that Paul asked a moment ago, from Illinois about, you know, healthcare as a right. Obviously, when I talk about healthcare as a right, we mean mental health care as well. And there is no question that there are, God knows how many, I mean, at least hundreds of thousands of people walking the streets right now, of all of our states, who are hurting, who may be suicidal, who may be homicidal, who are spiraling out of control, as you've indicated, and are not getting the help that they need. No question about that. And we need a revolution in terms of mental health in this country, but it's part of the overall revolution that we need in terms of making sure that everybody, regardless whether it's a broken leg, whether it's cancer, whether it's mental health, gets the health care that they need.
Howard in Hollywood, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, I say frack to fracking. It comes to air and other natural forms of energy. We've got them. But I'm the guy that called you, Bernie, and talked about the Republicans being much better marketers than us. And I still want to hear a hearing or see a hearing on the Mies shutdown. That would have paid for a lot of food stamps. And the other issue that is not brought up, and I don't understand why, is that since Ronald Reagan, all the Republican presidents are responsible for all of the national debt, about $12.6 trillion, considering Obama's first year was Bush's budget. $12.6 trillion, $11.6 trillion was Republican presidents, and now they're acting as if they're the misers of the budget.
Right.
A joke.
Howard, well, you make several good points, and I would agree with you, and I have in the past. The Democrats are not, I think, as effective in framing the issues and coming up with talking points as the Republicans are. I think it's an ironic situation. I guess the less that you have to say, or when you have nothing to say, then you really hone your means of saying it. And those people who actually do take seriously the problems facing our country and are trying to come up with real solutions to those problems have a little bit harder time framing those issues. Your point about Republicans causing debt is a very good point, and you're quite right, and I think that most people don't understand that. And let's just remember where we are today. Our Republican friends say, let's see, we've got to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, food stamps, because we have this very, very high deficit. That's their argument. Well, how did we get that high deficit? How did it happen that when Clinton left office in 2001 and Bush took over, we were running a very significant surplus? Well, what do you think, Howard? Do you think that's an issue worth discussing? And the answer, of course, is that under Bush, we went into two wars, which will end up costing us somewhere around $3 to $6 trillion, and our Republican colleagues were not very interested in paying for those wars. We gave huge tax breaks to billionaires and millionaires, and our Republican friends were not interested in offsetting that. Passed Medicare Part D, expensive program, wasn't paid for. So you're quite right that what Republicans have a habit of doing is taking us into debt, and then they say, isn't it terrible? We're in debt. We have to cut programs that impact working families. So I think that is a point that should be made a lot more than it is.
Rich in Broadheadsville, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Bernie, big fan of yours. You're like a rock star in my household. Me and my wife, a member of AFSCME in Pennsylvania. But an issue, Mr. President brought up this today, you know, the long-term unemployment. But I think another issue that needs to be looked at, as seriously looked at, is those who have companies do background checks on people, and I understand they want to weed out the felons, the violent criminals and whatnot, but somebody who's like me, who has just been hired today, I start February 10th, thank God and thank you for all you do, but somebody who has a criminal background of a nonviolent misdemeanor, you know, a simple theft, are being discriminated against when they are well qualified. This happened to me twice, and it's happening to probably hundreds of thousands of Americans. Just because they have a record from 10, 15, 20 years ago, these companies are discriminating against them and weeding out who they can. I think this is an issue that needs to be looked at, along with the long-term unemployment. Thank you for your work. You have our support, and I'll listen to
Rich,
your answer
you
online. Thank
and,
you.
And I think you make a very good point, and that point may be compounded by the fact that there are a whole lot of folks who have arrest records regarding drugs and nonviolent activities as well. And what happens is then as people who have done dumb things in their lives, which later on they regret, they're trying to get their feet back on the ground, trying to get a good job, develop income, have a family, in a sense, they are constantly having to deal with something that they may have done 20 years earlier. So I think, you know, I think your point is a good point.
Yeah. Bernie, we just have 45 seconds. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, the first business I ever had failed, and we declared bankruptcy. It was on my record for 7 years, and then it went away. We used to say back then, this goes away. Now it doesn't.
Well, I and also as a result of technology now, you know, whatever you do there, somebody's got a record of it for the next, you know, zillion years.
Yeah. It's a tough one.
I think Rich raises a very legitimate concern. That's something that we should be thinking about.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Okay, we'll be back with more calls for Senator Sanders. It is our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Saturday at 1 o'clock, tomorrow, 1 o'clock, he's going to have, and it'll be live on his website as well, he's going to have a town hall meeting in Montpelier at the City Hall about the NSA with a couple of nationally known speakers, plus Bernie himself taking
You're
pressure.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
At sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this. Welcome back. And Tim in Athens, Georgia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Bernie, thanks for taking my call. You know, missing from the State of the Union address was any mention of Latin America. And so specifically, I'm interested to hear your own thoughts on how you think the U.S. and Venezuela could begin to repair their relationship and how you think, as a socialist, the U.S. government should engage with Venezuela.
Well, I think the United States should be engaging with every country in Latin America. I think in recent years our attention has kind of waned, and we have not been paying a whole lot of attention to Latin America, and I think we should. They can become very important trading partners for us. We have seen in Brazil and other countries some really significant gains economically in terms of lowering poverty rates, improving health care, improving education, improving energy. They are natural allies of ours. And I really think there has been a serious problem. It's interesting that you asked that question. I hope to be going to several Latin American countries in the next few months. But there has been, I think, a real lack of attention toward Latin America as we focus on countries throughout the world.
Donna in Lodi, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. Senator, I was hoping that you would consider a form of therapy for veterans that research has been done, helps veterans release trauma. It's called craniosacral therapy. There's been research done from the Upledger Institute in Florida, and I've been practicing craniosacral therapy for 20 years, and tissue has memory. Once that tissue has been released from the memory, the trauma is released out of the body, and healing takes place.
Well, thank you. Actually, I have heard of that therapy, and thank you very much for the work that you are doing.
you know, I can't speak for the VA, but I can tell you that our goal is to expand alternative therapies. That's something that exists in legislation, which I hope will be on the floor next Thursday. And you know, the goal is to take a look at any and all therapies and see, in fact, if they are legitimate and if they work. So I would hope very much that the VA will be taking a look at that particular form.
Okay. Ryan in Newport, Maine. Ryan, we just have 1 minute till the break. Quick question for Bernie.
Yep. Bernie, I was just curious what your solution would be to lower gas prices. You know, I just wanted to say, I mean, I can't, you know, realistically, you know, afford like a hybrid or a solar vehicle. And, you know, I just remember that when Clinton left office, you know, in my area, gas averaged like 95 cents and now it's like 350. So how would you fix that? Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, we have that problem here in Vermont, and especially in Vermont, we find, interestingly enough, that where I am talking to you right now, I'm from in Burlington, Vermont, at 20 miles down the road in towns of Middlebury or in Rutland, 30 or 40 miles down the road, prices are significantly cheaper. So some of it has to do with the fact that in certain areas of the country and in the state of Vermont, you have a handful of companies that own the gas stations and, in fact, are not engaged in any kind of serious form of competition. The bigger issue, I think, has to do with the power of ExxonMobil and these very profitable oil companies. And don't underestimate Wall Street speculation on the oil, the energy futures market. Those are the contributing factors that make gas prices much higher than they should be.
Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Your
statement about gas prices.
Oh, yeah, sure. Hang on just a second, Bernie. Let me put Steve back on hold and go for it.
I just wanted to make sure that people heard the issue of oil prices is complicated and it is multifaceted. Issue number one, ExxonMobil and the other oil companies year after year make huge profits ripping off the American people. Issue number two, one of the reasons that oil prices are so high is not just the oil companies, but Wall Street speculation. Many of these Morgan Stanley and other companies are investing very, very heavily in oil futures. The oil futures market, and their goal is simply to drive up prices and sell and make a profit. And thirdly, what we see in Vermont and many other states in the country are in various communities kind of a lot of a wink and a nod in terms of competition, and people are keeping prices artificially high. The end result is that the average consumer is paying a lot more at the pump than he or she should be paying.
Okay. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, I went in business in 1973 during the Nixon administration. And at that time, the cheapest amount of money that I could hire anybody at is $10 an hour. And I was in construction. And because of the booming economy in the Washington area, that was my low budget laborer. And I'm just trying to figure out why $10 an hour is impressive, which Elizabeth Warren says because of quantitative easing, it should be more like $19 an hour. And I hit the exact same number. And going back to your gas thing, that is the reason why gas is so expensive, because the dollar has been destroyed. 50% of the value of the dollar has gone away.
Well, let me just say that in terms of, if your point is that back in 1973, construction workers were making 10 bucks an hour, and today there are construction workers today, 2014, who are making less than that, people in construction, you know, what this is about is the collapse of the middle class. It's about the collapse of trade unionism. It is about a trade policy which has led us into a race to the bottom. So for many people, $10 an hour in certain communities is actually a good wage today. But you add all of those factors together, and it's not just in construction. You go to the automobile industry. New people now getting jobs in Detroit and in automobile manufacturing are being paid significantly less than was previously the case. So there are a whole lot of reasons for that. But the bottom line is what you talk about speaks to the collapse of the working class in this country, and that real wages for millions and millions of people have declined precipitously. And that's what this whole struggle is about in terms of income and wealth inequality. It's how we create a movement which creates political power for working people,
which results in legislation which starts improving the lives of ordinary people rather than the very, very wealthy.
Jared, in watching us on Free Speech TV on the cable system there in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jared?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
you're on the air.
I would like to make a comment, but first I'd like to make just an observation. Bernie may not remember a conversation that we had. He had just been elected mayor. The chair wasn't even warm yet. And I approached him and said, how would you like to have the farmer's market in City Hall Park? Why not? And that's the end of the conversation. It happened, and I took his strong support and talked with a bunch of people, and it happened. What I would like to talk to you all is the various NAFTA, CAFTA, and the proposed TPP. I'd like to add one more: Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade, which would be known as SHAFTA.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jared.
Thank you for reminding me about that. We did that. We have we put the farmers market in Burlington, Vermont, right near City Hall, and on the street right alongside of it has been enormously successful. And on any given Saturday in the summertime, you'll find thousands and thousands of people there, and many vendors and craftspeople and everything else. In terms of trade policy, this is an issue that does not get the kind of discussion that it should. And the reason I think for that is you have the entire ruling class of America, all the corporations, all the banks, and unfortunately, up until recently, by the way, leadership of both political parties. You've had unfettered free trade being pushed by Ronald Reagan, being pushed by Bush the First, pushed by Bill Clinton, pushed by Bush the Second, pushed by Barack Obama. And you've had, in a sense, a bipartisan effort to support unfettered free trade. Now, something very interesting happened recently, and that is that as TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a huge trade agreement, including Vietnam, Australia, and so forth and so on, as that has been worked on, the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, Harry Reid, said, well, you know what, I'm not supportive of that. And so whether or not that very dangerous bill gets to the floor of the Senate remains to be seen. But I appreciate very much Senator Reid, who is the majority leader in the Senate, expressing his very strong concerns about that legislation, concerns that I share.
It is great, Jared, coming out. You know, most of those TPP countries are in the Southern Hemisphere of Asia. So we got NAFTA, CAFTA, and SHAFTA. It's amazing. And Bernie, we got 30 seconds to wrap up the show. Your thoughts for the end of the week?
Well, once again, I want to invite people to visit our website this Saturday, 1 o'clock. We'll be doing a town meeting with some of the leaders, civil libertarians in this country, talking about what I view as to be the unconstitutional activities of the NSA. We'll also be talking about the private sector and privacy rights. Next week, there's going to be a lot of stuff taking place in the Senate. I hope people pay attention. Hope they call their senators and get involved.
Yeah, great. And also the House of Representatives with regard to this fast-track thing. That's a big deal. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Always great having you on. And his website, once again, sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. It's Anything Goes Friday, although I've got a couple of stories here that I've got to tell you about. That are pretty shocking. A possibility of deflation, that's also known as Great Depression. BBC talking about it for Europe, and Paul Krugman talking about it for Turkey.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. ITM Trading. America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com. You say it, they will build it. Granger. for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Breaking news on numerous fronts. The first, hot off the presses, actually hot out of our printer. It's on the New York Times, just popped up on the New York Times front page. I'm assuming it's on the front page. It was forwarded to me in email, but the State Department released a report on Friday that could pave the way, this is Coral Davenport writing for the New York Times, that could pave the way toward President Obama's approval of the Keystone XL pipeline. And basically what they say is that whether we build the pipeline or not, this stuff is going to come out of the ground. And so the conclusions of the report appear to indicate that the project has passed Mr. Obama's climate criteria, as Coral Davenport writes in today's New York Times, an outcome expected to outrage environmentalists. You think? The State Department's been looking at this since 2008. The State Department, of course, under the purview of the Secretary of State, one former Senator John Kerry, actually former President John Kerry, in my opinion. But the only I would say the old Firesign Theater line about Ben Franklin, the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States. But Al Gore shares that distinction. So what can you say? And you know, Jimmy Carter agrees with me on the Al Gore one. I mean, has said so publicly. In fact, has said so publicly and said so well that I think it even bears repeating. If I can bring it up, but anyhow, this by the way, courtesy of the Carter Library.
The energy crisis.
Oh no, that's the energy crisis. Wrong speech. That's definitely. Oh yeah, here it is.
There's no doubt in my mind that Al Gore was elected president.
It's a speech he was giving, a public speech, in the public.
He received the most votes nationwide, and in my opinion, he also received the most votes in Florida.
And then he goes on from there. So, anyway, there are political, and so here we have the, it looks like Keystone XL is going to go through. The fact of the matter is they're already pumping oil through the thing. They're pumping sweet crude or heavy crude. I don't know which it is, but they're pumping crude oil. It's just a matter of starting to pump that tar sands, you know, down to the Koch brothers refineries so that it can be, so that we can get the poison and Mexico and Brazil and China and England can get the gasoline and the diesel fuel. Okay, that's number one. Number two, David Wildstein, the guy who said to Bridget Ann Kelly or whatever her name is, the Bridget Kelly, I guess, the guy who was working in Christie's office in the Port Authority, he's basically today his lawyer said that when Chris Christie said that he didn't know that the bridge lanes to onto the George Washington Bridge, that you know, from the town of Fort Lee, that he didn't know that those things were closed, that he was lying. And Wildstein says, you know, he's got proof that Christie is lying, and if that's the case, well, I guess, you know, if you hold a press conference for 2 hours and you lie repeatedly, you're not under oath, and so it's not prosecutable, but it certainly, I think, ends the probability that Chris Christie is going to be the guy running for Republican president of the United States. Actually, my prediction is that it'll be Mitt Romney again, but heaven only knows. I mean, they're doing such an effort to rehabilitate him from the HBO special to, you know, Anne, and I mean, you know, it's really quite amazing. It's quite clear to me that he's trying to take a second bite at the apple. And I may be wrong, and this may be crazy, but there have been people who have run for president before and then run again. Oh yeah, John McCain is running. Well, actually, he didn't make it all the way to the actually running for president, did he? I don't think he was an actual candidate against anybody. He was a candidate in 2008, but he wasn't a candidate a second time. And so, but you know, Grover Cleveland did. Grover Cleveland was a candidate two times with an intervening president, but he won both times. So there's probably in the history of America somebody who was a candidate and actually ran and actually lost and came back and was a candidate again and actually ran and either won or lost. But I don't know off the top of my head who it is. If so, we'll see. We'll see how all this shakes out. It's still early. The BBC. Business news, fall in Eurozone inflation rate fuels deflation concerns. This the BBC pointing out that the Eurozone inflation fell 0.7% in January, and it was at 0.8% in December. So inflation is only 0.1% for January. And the EU is trying to keep inflation at 2%. When inflation goes negative, that's called deflation. We have another word for deflation, at least when it's protracted, when it extends over a period of time. That word is depression. BBC does not use that word, but what they do say is concerns about possible deflation, where the price of goods and assets are locked in long-term decline, hitting corporate profits, wage growth, and tempting consumers to delay purchases in the hope of further price falls have grown in recent months. See, deflation is this devolutionary rather than evolutionary spiral. It's where the economy just spins down out of control. It's what happened in 1929, 1930, 1931, 1932. And it's what happened for a brief period of time in 2008. And Europe is very concerned that it might be about to happen there. I thought that there was an absolutely brilliant column that you really should read today by Paul Krugman in the New York Times. And what he is pointing out, you know, the market has been down the last few days. And most of this week. In fact, maybe I think all of this week. Last couple of weeks, the market's been down quite a bit. And so the counter market, you know, things, FXX, I think is one of them, whatever they are. The bet against the market funds are up, the hedge funds. But they're hemorrhaging right now in Argentina. The Argentinian peso is like under assault. And Paul Krugman does not actually point out that Paul Singer's hedge fund, one of these big hedge funds in New York, won a judgment. They bought up a bunch of when Argentina defaulted on their bond obligations in 2000 or 2001, those bonds were still out there. Argentina just said, we're not going to pay anymore. So the value of the bonds became like a penny on the dollar. And so Singer's hedge fund and a bunch of others bought up these bonds for a penny on the dollar, and then he took it all the way to the courts and actually got a judgment that Argentina had to pay him a whole bunch of money. And I don't know if that's what's driving this or not, but that's certainly not helping Argentina. But the point that Paul Krugman makes is that we had this period of stability from the end of World War II until basically the late 70s, early 80s, the last couple of years of the Carter administration, the beginning of the Reagan administration, where one country's problems didn't infect other countries. And there was a reason for that. You know how with regard to trade, we used to have tariffs. We used to have basically a semi-permeable membrane around the United States, tariffs and trade policies. And we did away with that in the 90s, and that was not good. We also used to have something like that for finance. And we started doing away with that in the late 70s and the early 80s. And that's the problem.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And so basically he's saying that ever since the, you know, ever since 1980, more or less, we've been at risk worldwide of these boom and bust cycles. We've been having them, not just at risk. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, presidents who've been nominated twice and lost. Oh, this is interesting. The first true partisan example, this was Charles Pinckney in 1804 and 1808. Both times he was nominated by the Federalist Party. In 1804, he lost to Thomas Jefferson, and in 1808, he lost to James Madison. And it was actually, he was the third one. William Jennings Bryan ran as the Democratic nominee in 1896 and in 1900. And again in 1908, Bryan ran three times and lost every time. Thomas Dewey ran in 44 and 48. Lost to FDR, then he lost again to Harry Truman. Adlai Stevenson ran as the Democratic nominee in 52 and 56, both times losing to Dwight Eisenhower. John Adams, 1789 and 1792, both times losing to George Washington, although the setup for elections back then was a little different. Eugene Debs, of course, you know, ran four times as a socialist. James Weaver ran as a greenback and populist. Eugene Chafin on the Prohibition ticket. And Ross Perot ran twice in 92 and 96. But those were all minor party. But I'm talking about major party. Henry Clay lost three elections. 1824, he lost to John Quincy Adams. In 1832, he lost to Andrew Jackson. And in 1844, he lost to James Polk. That's got to be painful. That's got to be really painful. So, interesting. So maybe I'm not as crazy as I thought I was. That didn't come out right, did it? Anyhow, let me just pick up a phone call here. Free Speech TV, Jeff in North Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Jeff, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to talk about that frequently mentioned graph that you have on your show from time to time. Productivity versus wage compensation?
Yes.
It's coincident until about the 1980s, then it diverges. And I'm in my late 50s, so I remember back in the 70s when, I don't know, the minimum wage was like $2.50 an hour, a gallon of gas was maybe 30 cents a gallon, a new house was $60,000,
right.
A new car was about $6,000 or $7,000. So, and you could go back to the, say, 1940s or 50s and find similar examples, you know, with the prices and wages proportionately less.
Right.
So if those two lines were coincident from the 1980s up till now, you know, they
right.
corresponded and fell on top of each other, wouldn't a new house be, you know, $840,000 and a new car be $89,000 and a gallon of gas be, you know, $9.23.
No, because prices actually have gone up, wages have not. Yeah, you've seen, you know, the rate of inflation has been relatively unchanged. I mean, there was a spike, you know, after the Arab oil embargo, after both of them actually, in the 70s and early 80s. But basically, the inflation rate since World War II has been unchanged. So prices have continued to rise, but in real dollars, productivity has continued to rise. Wages have remained flat. So no, the price of a house would be what it is today. The price of a gallon of gas would be what it is today. But the minimum wage would be $17 today, and the average wage would be around $20 or $25 today. So that's, yeah, you can do the math on it, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call. Okay, I got there's just a whole bunch of things that I wanted to share with you today. One about Kathy McMorris Rogers, the woman who gave the State of the Union rebuttal. She hates government. The only job she's ever had since she left Pensacola Christian University is in government. Stevens County, her home. The unemployment rate was 30% above the national average last year, according to Timothy Egan in today's New York Times, his op-ed titled When Biography Trumps Substance. One in six people in her hometown live below the poverty level. One in five are in food stamps. The leading employer, providing about a third of all the jobs, was the government. Yet she voted to cut food stamps. She voted to cut emergency benefits for the unemployed. And Tim Egan says, and I quote, she has been a leading strategist in the unrelenting Republican attempt to kill the Affordable Care Act, end quote. Yet in her district, signups are 102% of the state target for Obamacare. She says Obamacare isn't working. But the people in her district are signing up like there's no tomorrow. One in 12 people in her home county have signed up. So it's, and you know, then four times she said, we have a plan, but then she never, we have plans, but she never said what the plans were. There were no specifics whatsoever in the official Republican speech. It was basically, as Tim Egan says, you know, we're not all angry white guys. There are some white women, I guess, sitting on a couch in their home, in their place. Right. Okay, so there's that. The lead story on Huffington Post right now is how, actually it's pointing, yeah, HuffPost Business, Jeffrey Young's article, millions are now realizing they're too poor for Obamacare. And it talks about this guy down in Florida. Florida did not take the Medicaid expansion. And so in Florida, you have to make at least $15,300 a year before you can qualify for Obamacare. So if you make $14,000 a year in Florida, you are below the poverty level. You can sign up for, you theoretically should be able to sign up for Obamacare and get Medicaid, get it for free, but you can't because they didn't take the Medicaid expansion. Now, there's a gotcha on Medicaid, and this I thought was fascinating. The gotcha on Medicaid is what's called a state recovery, that Medicaid is basically a loan. And after you die, they can come after whatever you leave behind. The state can. Turns out this is something that ALEC has been promoting. They didn't, I mean, this was established in 65, and it was, quote, enhanced in 1993 when Congress required states to institute that provision for people who die who are over 55 and taking Medicaid. So if you're over 55 and you get Medicaid, you have to pay it back. In 2013, the American Legislative Exchange Council encouraged states, quote, to conduct a study to examine the estate recovery program and determine options the state has to improve recovery under and increase the efficiency of the program. In September 2004, ALEC put out a report calling on states to enhance the enforcement of estate recovery programs. This is the way Medicaid works is if you're over 55 and you go on Medicaid, so if you're poor, if you're making less than $15,300 and you're in one of the states that has expanded Medicaid, or you know, you are poor enough, like you make less than $4,000 in Louisiana, that you qualify for Medicaid. If you are over 55, it's no longer we're just paying your bills. It's now it's a loan, and when you die, we get to go after whatever you leave behind. Or if you have anything, you have to get really poor fast. This was a Republican idea, and ALEC has been promoting it and trying to strengthen it. And it turns out it varies from state to state how they, you know, what they recover, how they recover it, how they do it. Thus, ALEC gets involved with like model legislation or model promotions. In a press release in September 2004, ALEC suggested, quote, a strong estate recovery program to generate alternative non-tax revenue and make Medicaid a loan, not a grant, for the middle class as intended by federal law, end quote. This is something we need to fix. And, in fact, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, their spokesperson, Aaron Albright, told the Washington Post recently, we recognize the importance of this issue and will provide states with additional guidance in this area soon. This is something that's worthy of talking to your member of the House of Representatives, your two senators, and your state representative and your state senator or assembly person or whatever it may be called, wherever you live, is why is it that if I'm over 55 and I go on Medicaid, it's a loan, not a grant? I realize the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, this group, you know, funded by the billionaires, promoted by, you know, the Koch brothers and all these other billionaires, helped out, whatever, co-founded by Paul Weyrich back in the day, you know, the guy who said, I don't want everybody to vote. And ALEC has promoted those laws, the voter suppression laws. ALEC has promoted on behalf of the National Rifle Association, another one of their members and large contributors, promoted the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws that, you know, led to the Trayvon Martin murder in Florida and the George Zimmerman, who now says he will box anybody in a feature. You know, he's going to get paid to get beat up. Or something. I don't know. He's. But anyway, that's all ALEC, right? ALEC brought us this stuff. And they're continuing to do this kind of stuff, only they're getting more and more sneaky about it. More and more, you know, oh, really? You're the press? You're not allowed here. Yes, I'm security. Are you really security for the hotel? No, actually, I'm security for ALEC. Oh, really? I mean, it's getting bizarre. Anyhow, I'm it's ranting way too much for Anything Goes Friday. This is the kind of thing I do Monday through Thursday. So I am going to open the phone lines after this break, and I see that every single line is filled anyway. We will be picking up your calls and for the rest of the day. So we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Also, free-don.org. Don Siegelman's, the website, the Friends of Don website, they're talking about Selma, Alabama. I'll tell you about that a little later. Free-don.org. Don Siegelman, the website of the Friends of Don Siegelman, working to free one of America's few political prisoners. I would say Leonard Pelletier is also in that category. But free-don.org is suggesting that there's going to be this in Selma, Alabama, on March 9th. So we still have, you know, a few weeks. I'll remind you again as we get closer. There's going to be this, a remembrance of the bloody Sunday sacrifices that were made on March 7th, 1965. And he says, I want my supporters to rally for freedom and justice for all American prisoners and all women and men and women of ethnic minority who face injustice every single day. If you have a loved one in prison and take issue with their case, bring a homemade sign, free my daughter, free my son, free my husband. And I would add, you know, free-don.org. Check it out. So that's what's going on. Anyhow, I got a few other things I'll get to in the next hour. It's time to pick up phone calls. Ashes, listening to WCPT in Chicago. Hey, Ashes, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have a question. Do you think all these the Supreme Court ruling of our Citizens United, all these Republican policies that they keep passing when Bush was in power, that they keep passing these knowing that the American public is so apathetic towards politics and stuff like that they don't care what the government passes, and they just pass them because they know they don't want to have any opposition or movement by people changing the...
Here's a shocking statistic. 49% of the people in America who could be covered by Medicaid under Obamacare don't know that they could be covered for free. 49%. This was a recent Pew poll. And, I mean, that's astounding. That's how bad the administration has been at messaging, or how bad the media has been at just spreading the word about something that's actually going on in America, as opposed to whether or not Justin Bieber should be deported, or how good the Republicans and Fox News have been at obfuscating, you know, confusing people. I don't think it's that the American people are dumb. That's a path that I'm not willing to go down, Ashes. I think that there might be a small subset of people who are far more interested in sports than politics. Actually, that's not a small subset. It's a fairly large subset. And there's a fairly large subset of people who are working three jobs and don't even have the time to listen to the news or read a newspaper. and they're just trying to get by, and they just go on what the guy who's working next to them during some of those jobs said, and that guy working next to them happens to listen to Rush Limbaugh on the way home every day, or you know, watches Fox News or something, and that's how they get their news. I mean, it's like I have a friend who gets his news that way, basically. You know, it's, you know, from right wing talk radio, and it's really weird having a conversation with him. You know, he's like, oh, what do you think about this? It was just a couple days ago. Hey, how's this global warming? You know, just somebody I know down in the marina. And I said, yeah, it's actually cold because of global warming. He says, yeah, right. And it's like, what do you say? You know, well, let me sit down and explain the science to you. No, I have no interest in science. You know, I know it's a conspiracy. You know, the senator from Oklahoma told me. Anyhow,
my family is the same way. I mean, when we all get together, especially my cousins, they're like my same age, and they just don't. When I try to talk to them about government politics, they don't care. They just want to talk about football, basketball, music, pop culture, stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think it's that, you know, the strategic the strategy of the Republican Party has been break government and then blame it on the Democrats that it's broken. And I think the Democratic Party and most Democrats and most progressives for a long time, you know, through the 60s and 70s and 80s, as this strategy was being worked out and put into place, thought the American people are not going to fall for that. They're not that stupid. And in fact, the American people have fallen for it. And as I said, it's not because they're stupid, but I think that, you know, a lot of people are just so disenchanted, so disheartened by the political system, by politics, that they've tuned out. And this, you know, this is why I wrote the book, The Crash of 2016. It's going to take a major crash to cause those people to say, what the hell's going on? And actually start paying attention and looking for actual information. And then the question will be, do they end up, you know, getting that actual information from the Drudge Report and Fox News, or do they get it from pretty much any other rational news source that will actually tell them what's going on? Ashes, thanks for the call. Arthur in Homewood, Illinois. Hey, Arthur, you wanted to talk about trade policy with China?
Good afternoon. I really appreciate talking to you.
Thank you.
Listen, Bernie Sanders says we've got infrastructure, okay? Guess where all that steel comes from? We used to have the... I'm in an area where we had the greatest steel production in the world. United States Steel, Reynolds Steel, Minnesota Mining Steel. We had steel mills galore, beautiful steel. Everybody in the world.
I know. When I was born, my dad worked in a Reynolds
infrastructure.
Steel mill.
And guess where that steel's coming from? Made in China.
Yep.
Number one. Number two now, about the minimum wage.
Yep.
Here in Chicago, the age from 16 to 30 is 80% unemployment. And guess what the city council of Chicago is pushing? $19 an hour minimum wage. Can you imagine how many of these kids are? It'll be 100%.
I don't think it will be. Because what will happen is if first of all, most of those businesses that are minimum wage businesses are staffed at their minimum staffing right now. In other words, if you got a burger joint, you got a guy doing the fries, you got a guy flipping burgers, you got somebody working the counter, and you got somebody working the window. I mean, where are you going to cut somebody if the wages go up? So number one. And number two, if the wages go up, you're going to have more minimum wage workers coming in to buy burgers. So there's going to be more demand for their product. They may actually have to hire an extra guy to work the counter to work the cash register. They may have to hire an extra guy to, you know, to flip more burgers. So look at the history of the minimum wage. The minimum wage has been increased somewhere between 20 and 30 times since it first came into being back in 1935. And every time the minimum wage has gone up nationally, and if you look state by state, every time the minimum wage has gone up on an individual state, what follows that is a burst of economic activity, not layoffs. And if there was even one single example where the minimum wage going up, and it has gone up in really big increments. I mean, in some of the states, it's gone up over a dollar in 1 year, right? And at the federal level, the equivalent of almost a dollar in 1 year. If any 1 year had caused there to be layoffs, if there was any one year, Arthur, the Republicans would be saying, you don't want to repeat the mistake of 1973 when they raised the minimum wage and unemployment went up, you know.
$10 an hour?
Well, I don't live in Chicago. I don't know what the conditions are. I don't know what they're talking about. But the point is, whatever it is, 19 might be a little high, but whatever it is, if you have a situation where, like in the fast food industry, where basically that industry or the Walmarts of the world, every Walmart costs the country $1 million because we're subsidizing their workers. You pay those workers $19 an hour. We're no longer subsidizing them. Our taxes go down. Walmart's wages go up.
I love talking to you.
Okay.
I can't out-talk you. This I will not try to do.
Okay. And I would say probably $19 an hour is the point at which people are making enough that they qualify for no government benefits whatsoever, which means that you and I are no longer spending $1 million per Walmart store to subsidize these folks. But I don't frankly know. I mean, it might be as low as $15 an hour. But Arthur, check out. I guarantee you, if there was any, the Republicans would be saying, if I used to live in Oregon, right? And I remember when in Portland, they said, this is a huge minimum wage increase. In Portland, Oregon, it used to be that people who are waiters, tipped workers, they were making, the minimum wage for tipped workers was like $2.35 or $3. It was less than $3 an hour, as I recall. And they said, those people have to be paid the state minimum wage that everybody else gets, which was like $8.50, right? Or somewhere in that neighborhood. So this was like a $5 or $6 increase in 1 day in the minimum wage for tipped workers in the city of Portland, Oregon, which is, almost 1 million people. And the restaurant industry was running around with their hair on fire going, if this happens, we're going to have to lay off 20% of our workforce. It's going to be a disaster. You're going to see Portland's going to go down in flames. You're talking about a $5 increase in the minimum wage? Really? It's 100%. This is a 300% increase. Or 200%. We're doubling. But the city council did it anyway. The people voted for it anyway. It happened. And what happened? Economic activity went up. The restaurants were actually more profitable the next year than they were the year before, and they continue to be profitable. I was just back in Portland a month or so ago visiting our kids who live there, and restaurants are great. Restaurateurs are happy. People doing a good job. They like their job, and they spend that money so the economy does well. Arthur, thanks for the call. But please don't believe this lie that it has been promoted ever since the minimum wage was put in 1935, that it causes unemployment. If it had ever caused unemployment, they would be saying, don't forget 1961 when that day, if they had a year that they could point to, if they had a state, don't forget Portland, Oregon. They don't have
You're one. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Never, ever, anywhere has raising the minimum wage caused unemployment to get worse. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Stephen, watching us on Free Speech TV in Deming, Washington. Hey, Stephen, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on. A couple points I wanted to make. Just super quick, I was really thrilled to hear the Senator Bernie just even mention geothermal. I think mm-hmm. it's gotten short shrift big time, and it has a huge amount of potential that isn't being recognized yet. I'm glad to see it's finally getting some notice.
We did our show live from Reykjavik, Iceland, about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, and 98% of the country gets their power that way. 98% of the city is heated that way. I mean, we're sitting in a hotel room, and the room is lit by geothermal. It is heated by geothermal. And the country's on an active volcano, but it's pretty impressive. It's pretty, and we could see the geothermal factory from we were in one of the top floors of the hotel, and it looked out over the geothermal factory, which was right near the ocean, right by the bay there. And we could just, you could see it. You can see all this electricity being produced by the water being circulated through these you know, down into the, not the volcano itself, but you know what I'm talking about. It's incredible.
Right. And if a closed loop system gets used so that there's no release of steam, there's virtually no exhaust or release at all, not even of the heat.
That's right.
Or water.
That's right. And what they do in Iceland is they have a steam system throughout the city, so you know, they generate the electricity on site, and then they take that surplus heat as steam and they pump it throughout the city, and then people use steam heat.
Right, and it's a closed loop system, just like a radiator on a car.
Yeah, basically.
A heat exchange.
Yep.
The other thing, I know a lot of people who listen to your show are very much feeling inclined to want Senator Sanders to run for president. And
yes,
I've put a bit of thought of that to myself. I can't think of any congressional representative who would be more appropriate in terms of helping us survive the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to think, what would give him the best chance of actually succeeding and becoming the president? And just my two cents on the matter, I think if he were to enter campaign within the Democratic Party as forming a new wing, a center wing, or the people's wing of the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm.
so to distinguish himself as not just another Democrat, he would have a tendency to unite Democrats and also to draw independents who might be feeling a little bit disenchanted with the Democratic Party at this point in time.
It's possible. There's a lot of independents. I mean, I find it really interesting. Maine has elected an independent senator, Angus King. Vermont has elected an independent senator, Bernie Sanders. You got Marianne Williamson out in Los Angeles running for Henry Waxman's seat, and he's now declared that he's not going to run for reelection. So, you know, independent, you know, maybe this is the decade of the independent or the year of the I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, it's Bernie represents some real interesting possibilities. Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network there. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Indeed. James in Clear Lake, California. Hey, James, what's up?
Well, I was reading this article called The Big White Ghetto, and it was originally published in the National Review, and it's talking about people in the Appalachian region using their food stamps to buy sodas and supposedly sell them for various other substances. And, you know, it concludes basically with the idea that this is just more proof that Johnson's war on poverty failed.
Right. Let's blame poverty on poor people. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, what made me think of that, though, is somebody earlier called in and was talking about mental health, which is, you know, an extremely important issue, and I'm glad that Bernie, you know, supports it and everything. One of the claims that the article makes is that parents were pulling their children out of literacy classes so that they could continue to claim a disability, which brings in a disability check of about $700 a month. Now, if that's true, of course, I think it's obvious that the parents didn't choose that deliberately. And I'm reading some more information online here from some much better articles with more progressive slang, which really go into the efforts that are being made and the successful efforts that have so far been made to reducing poverty in the area and how, you know, different kinds of jobs might be promoted there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me that when we look at education, we have to focus on not everybody can be a lawyer or a doctor and go to college or become president. You know, we need to focus on things like you know, green jobs of the order that would be more right. Like in construction and renovation and so forth.
Yeah, West Virginia is a great example of where there could be a closed loop economy. I mean, it's possible. They do have some natural resources. I mean, they've got a massive amount of coal is the problem. You know, they have the problem that Nigeria has, for example, with oil. And it's owned by basically a small plutocratic bunch. And that has distorted the economy so badly. Were it not for that, then you could have a little more diverse economy like the states that are otherwise fairly resource poor and relatively rural like New Hampshire or Vermont have, where a good chunk of the economy is just people doing things for each other. You know, I build your house, you grow my food, and there's not much manufacturing going on, but there is an economy there. And I know that there's some real good efforts at cooperative building, cooperative economies, building a cooperative systems in West Virginia right now. And in fact, we're going to have as a guest on this program probably in the next month a group that is doing some really spectacular work in West Virginia. Louise and I are trying to get down there over one of these weekends first before we have these people on, because I've been reading about it in Yes Magazine and I've been hearing about it for a couple of years. You know, this new economic model for West Virginia. But conservatives for years, James, have made a really, really good living blaming poor people for poverty. And, you know, they did it back in the 19th century. They blamed the, you know, crime on the Irish first when it was waves of Irish immigrants after the potato famine and the poor were the Irish. And then they blamed it on the Italians in the 1890s when the poor were the Italian immigrants. And there were books about the Italian crime gene, you know, and how they were criminal people and all this kind of thing. And you know, of course, they blamed it on African Americans for years and years. And in Appalachia, they blame it on, you know, poor white people. I mean, they can't come up with some genetic theory, and they can't come up with some, you know, racial theory. So what do they have? Well, it must just be poor people are just bad, or it's the evil liberal government that created the social safety net that is keeping them in poverty. Well, no, it's keeping them from dying. So what we need to do is go a step further, frankly. We need to revive the war on poverty rather than kill it off. LBJ's war on poverty cut poverty in the United States in about 6 years in half. And the problem was that we stopped doing it. We've been systematically dismantling the war on poverty ever since 1980. In fact, the last 2 years of the Carter administration in some ways started that process. So, you know, I think we just need to go forward. And you look at the countries of Northern Europe where, you know, there are, I think, some parallels to be made. And they figured out how to do this. It's not rocket science. James, thanks for the call. Wayne in Lithonia, Georgia. Hey, Wayne. Wayne, you there?
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hey, Wayne. What's up? Wayne, I'm sorry. I can't hear you. Your phone is some kind of VoIP phone or something, or else I'm on a speakerphone. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Real quick aside, I was actually stationed in Iceland for a year, and they actually take the leftover waste heat in Reykjavik, and they run pipes under the sidewalks, and in the winter, all their sidewalks are warm and no snow or ice. How's that?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, nice.
Incredible.
Yeah. Blue Lagoon, all that wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm delusional, but I had an idea. Why don't we tie corporate taxes to wages? And what I'm saying is you start out with a corporate tax rate of 90%. Okay, if you pay below poverty wages, 90%. You pay poverty wages for a family of four, okay, now you pay 80%. You pay 10% above poverty wages, okay, now you're down to 70%. You get the idea.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
The idea is you tie how they share the wealth with how much of the wealth they get to keep.
That makes a lot of sense, you know, because people think that we pay taxes to fund government, and that's really not the case. In fact, there was no income tax. 100% of the funding of government from the founding of this country until the Civil War was from tariffs. Tariffs represented two-thirds of total income for the federal government up until World War I, and fully one-third of federal income was tariffs up until World War II. But as from the Civil War forward, as we started getting into taxes other than tariffs, and tariffs actually were designed to alter behavior as well. But the idea of taxes has been not only to pay, you know, raise revenue to pay for government, but also to modify behavior in ways that we think are socially desirable. So we've determined that it's socially desirable for people to get married. So when people get married, they get a tax advantage. We think it's socially desirable for people to have children. So if people get kids, they get a tax advantage. To own houses. You own a home, you get to incorporate. So you get an incorporation, you get a tax advantage. So, yeah, it makes perfect sense. I don't know about exactly where the price points would be, but the concept, Bill, I think is brilliant. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Thanks for calling and sharing it with us, and thanks for listening. We'll be back. It is coming up at the top of the hour. We'll be back with anything more of Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live in Washington, D.C. And just let me bring you up to date on some of the things we've been through today. Of course, we had Senator Sanders on for an hour taking your calls, and he had some very interesting things to say. One of the most interesting is that tomorrow in Montpelier, Vermont, in City Hall, he's going to be having a town hall meeting about the NSA and about the private sector as well and security issues. He's going to have a couple of keynote speakers, plus he's going to be speaking, and then he's going to be taking questions from the audience. And perhaps most significantly, because many of you are not in Montpelier, Vermont, is that it's going to be live on his website at sanders.senate.gov. And so you'll be able to watch it in real time. I don't know if there's any capability of interactivity at that website, but you can hang out with Bernie tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Eastern time. So, number one. Number two, we were talking about the Red State Donut Hole. Literally 5.5 million people who earn less than $15,300 a year who would have been eligible for free Medicaid, free health insurance. Just go to healthcare.gov and fill it in, and boom, you've got free health insurance. If you make less than $15,300 a year, that in 25 states, those people are showing up in these offices where they help people sign up, or they're showing up on the website and saying, hey, I only make $12,000 a year. I'd like that free health insurance. And they're discovering that their Republican governor, or in some cases, like in Florida, Governor Rick Scott and the Republicans in the Senate actually wanted to expand the Medicare program like Jan Brewer did, the Republican governor of Arizona. She held her legislature hostage. She said she would not sign any legislation until they passed an expansion of the Medicaid. Rick Scott didn't do that in Florida. And so the Republicans in the House of Representatives in Florida shot it down. And so now over 800,000 people in Florida who make less than $15,300 a year cannot get health insurance unless they are so poor, unless they make like less than $3,000 or $4,000 a year, that they qualify for the state Medicaid program. This is craziness. And on the state Medicaid program, the state pays, you know, the federal government pays 53 or 56% of it, and the state pays the rest of it. So it actually costs the state money. Had they signed up for the Medicaid expansion, that would have that 47% or 43% that the state is paying, that would have been reduced to zero. But for purely political reasons, the Republicans are saying 800,000 people can just get screwed. And then the lead story over at Huffington Post, they tell the story about this guy named Alphonse. Mark Alphonse, Alphonse is his last name. Mark Alphonse, he learned 3 years ago he's got a kidney disorder that within the next couple of years is going to kill him if it's not treated. And he's making $400 a month on unemployment benefits. So he's making less than $15,300 a year. He would qualify for free health insurance, free health care, free Medicaid. He and his family, he and his wife and his kids, 28-year-old wife and three young children. They would all be insured right now if the Republicans in Florida had said, yeah, we'll go along with Obamacare. But they're saying, no, we're going to try and sabotage it. Because after all, even though it was a Republican think tank, the Heritage Foundation, that came up with the idea. Actually, it was a Republican president, Richard Nixon, who first proposed it. Then the Heritage Foundation reprised it with some tweaks. And then a Republican governor, Mitt Romney, put it into place in Massachusetts. And then a Democratic president said, let's do that exact Republican thing. Oh, no, we can't go along with that. That's a Democratic president. Right. This is sad. And in fact, this Jason Connor is one of the guys who works in 764,000 low-income adults in Florida are no longer qualified. Jason Connor works at Miami's Borinquen Medical Center for low-income and uninsured patients. And he says, and I quote, we had people break down in tears at our desk. This is when people come in thinking that they're going to get free insurance because they're poor. And they're told, sorry, you would qualify for it if you lived in New York or California or Washington State or even Tennessee, you know, where they have expanded Medicaid. But the Republicans in the state won't let you have it. I don't know if they tell them that way. That's how they should tell them. They probably don't. I doubt they probably go out of their way not to make it partisan. But in any case, he said, we've had people break down in tears at our desk. Folks are frustrated and they're angry and they'll curse at you even though you have nothing to do with it, he said. And then they point out at the Borinquen Medical Centers, they see 50,000 patients a year. 78% are uninsured. And these people would qualify, but they don't qualify because the Republicans wouldn't take the money. I mean, this is mind-boggling. 764,000 people in Florida. So we talked about that. We talked about how Medicaid, if you're over 55 and you take this insurance. Now, this is Fox News started this thing there, or maybe they echoed it. I don't know. But it's bounced around the Foxosphere. It's bounced around the right-wing blogosphere that, oh, my God, the Obamacare expansion, if states take that Medicaid and you're over 55, you're going to have to pay that money back if you get sick. And at first, a lot of us thought, that's crazy. That can't be. It's got to be another lie about Obamacare, right? Well, it's got nothing to do with Obamacare. This is how the law was written back in 1965 in many states, not everywhere. In 1993, Congress passed a law requiring all the states to do this so that if you're over 55, Medicaid becomes a loan rather than a grant. The circumstances vary from state to state. And I've told you before, I learned about this when my mom got Alzheimer's and ultimately died of it. She lived with my brother until she died. But had we had to put her in a nursing home, we would have first had to sell basically everything that my parents still had left. You know, the house that I grew up in, my brothers and I grew up in, my mom's button collection, her antique collection, my dad's books, all of that stuff would have had to been sold, and all the money would have had to have been given to the state of Michigan, completely bankrupt my mom, basically. There would be no estate to pass down to the grandchildren for a college fund or something. It's not like they were rich. I mean, my dad's house, I think, ultimately sold for $85,000 or $90,000. But still, I mean, it was something. And it just blew my mind. You know, that we've got this system where if people are over 55, we're not actually paying. Well, it turns out that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has been hustling for this. In 2003, ALEC encouraged states, quote, to conduct a study to examine the estate recovery program, which is what I'm talking about, and determine options the state has to improve recovery and increase the efficiency of the program. In September 2004, ALEC put out a report on how to do this, and they sent out a press release saying that a strong estate recovery program to generate alternative non-tax revenue and make Medicaid a loan, not a grant for the middle class, as intended by federal law. This needs to be fixed. This needs to be fixed. Health care should not be a loan if you're over 55 and poor. That's crazy. Or not even poor. I mean, there was a woman the Washington Post told the story of her. She was a 54-year-old lawyer in New York City who was no longer working as a lawyer. She was poor. She was disabled. and she refused to go on Medicaid, even though she had low enough income to qualify for it. She was basically broke, but she owned her apartment. It had been bequeathed to her by a family member, her mom or her dad or brother. Somebody had died and left her this $850,000 apartment. She didn't have any money. But if she took Medicaid, she would have had to sell that apartment and give that money to the state of New York or burn through that money in nursing home care or whatever. And she's like, I'm not going to do that. That's wrong. That's a broken system. And it's exactly the way that Alec and the Republicans want it. It's just incredible. HSBC, the bank, this BBC News. HSBC has said, you want cash? This is the, I think it's the second largest bank in the world. It's the largest bank, I believe, in the UK. Listeners have told Radio 4's Moneybox they were stopped from withdrawing amounts ranging from 5,000 to 10,000 British pounds. No, you can't have your cash. Is this the beginning of a trend, and why?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
At the same time, the BBC is talking about deflation in the UK. We've heard of deflation, right? We had deflation here from 1929 to 1933. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Herman in Sacramento, California, watching us on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Herman, what's on your mind?
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
My pleasure.
I watch your show whenever I can.
Thank you.
Last time I had an opportunity to do this, was, I believe it was Monday, when you were critiquing the president's State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you were disappointed at what he said, that he could have said more. And to illustrate, I think you played some pieces from President Roosevelt's speech.
Yeah, you're thinking of Tuesday then. Monday was Harry Truman, Tuesday was Franklin Roosevelt. And let me put a little nuance on that. Yes, I was disappointed. I felt that the speech was very, very light on substance. And I also acknowledge the political reality of our day, that because the Supreme Court has said that money is protected by the First Amendment, and therefore billionaires meddling in politics are protected by the First Amendment, and I don't see that in the First Amendment. I don't think the founders meant it to be there, but the, you know, five of the nine justices in the Supreme Court believe that to be the case, and said so in 38 years ago in Buckley versus Vallejo, and then said so again in Citizens United. Because of that, the president is in a situation where there's really not much he can do. And so what he said was, the little that I can do, I'm going to do. And here's the little that I'm going to do. So it's just kind of a sad situation.
Well,
back
that's
to you.
True. And but the Roosevelt speech, you know, he was acting on things that had to be done quickly. Poverty,
yes,
back then in 1929 and 30s were more abstract. Poverty today is totally different.
Yeah.
We have, back then, we had homeless families because they were poor.
Yes.
We have poor people today. They have a lot of benefits that was never unheard of. They were unheard of back then.
You're right. There was no food stamps. There was no welfare.
That's,
I mean,
correct.
Franklin Roosevelt was starting with a blank slate. And
he had,
yeah,
to act.
Yeah.
Because it was immediate.
But the other thing is that Franklin Roosevelt had a 2/3 majority in the Senate and an almost 3/4 majority in the House. And so he could basically say to the American people, I want this legislation. And I quote at some length from the New York Times from 1933, his first year, in my book, The Crash of 2016. There's some fairly long quotes from the New York Times from back then, where literally Roosevelt would go on the radio and he would say, I need a piece of legislation that's going to create the Works Progress Administration. I can't do that myself by executive order. I could bring it into being, but I can't fund it. Congress has to fund it. I need the money. And the next day, people, every member of the House and the Senate would be overwhelmed with telegrams and phone calls and letters demanding that they give him what he wants, give the president whatever he wants, and he got it. And that's not the case now. Now you've got the Tea Party, you got Fox News, you got right-wing talk radio, you've got, you know, all this partisan stuff. I mean, you've got all this craziness. So it's a very different world.
There's another element that I don't know if it's being considered or not. You got to look at the background of a lot of these presidents. Look at Roosevelt's background. He was an aristocrat.
Yes.
Theodore Roosevelt was his cousin. He had power.
Yeah, he was actually his third cousin. They didn't know each other. But yes.
Obama doesn't have that.
Yes.
The problem is from a single mama, poor family. He's got to be careful.
I understand that. And also, he's African-American, or he's half African-American. He's identified as our first black president. And so every time he even sounds like he might be angry, he used the word damn in one interview. And Matt Drudge, Obama goes street, was the headline. All the whole right wing, you know, oh, Obama, angry black man. So, yeah, I understand that. It's a very different era, a different time, and a different guy. I get it. Thanks for the call. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, it's the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Oh, my. Silicon Valley. Somebody yesterday called and said, did you know that the CEOs in Silicon Valley conspired to drive down 100,000 technical engineers' wages? And I was like, no. Really? And this person started telling me about it, and I kind of cut the conversation short because I didn't really know if it was true or not, and you don't want to just, you know, let somebody go out and basically libel Steve Jobs or you know, the Eric Schmidt, you know, Bill Campbell from Apple and Eric Schmidt from Google. But it turns out that actually that's what happened. Mark Ames wrote about it January 23rd, 2014, in the Kilarowski.net is the piece, the article is the website that I'm looking at. I'm sure it's all over the web by how Silicon Valley's most celebrated CEOs conspired to drive down 100,000 tech engineers' wages. And basically, Eric Schmidt and Steve Jobs and a bunch of these guys got together and said, you know, we won't recruit from each other, and therefore we won't start a bidding war for wages. We won't compete for wages. Therefore, there won't be an open market for labor for these computer tech jobs, and therefore we can keep pay down. And the Justice Department actually got involved and is doing an investigation. There's a whole lot more detail beyond that, but I'll let you track that down. And then Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby says, David Green, the CEO, he says, being Christians, we don't pay for drugs that might cause abortions, which means we don't cover emergency contraception, the morning after pill or the week after pill. Okay. Well, here's the one thing you will find in a lot of Hobby Lobby stores is stuff made in China. And this article over at NorthshoreDad.typepad.com writes, North Shore Dad writes, in China, the government regularly forces women to undergo forced abortions, and then tells the story. Excuse me. Sneezing here. Tells the story of this woman who was forced to have an abortion in her seventh or eighth month and produced a stillborn baby after 35 hours of labor. And she was in pain and horrified, but it was a forced abortion. They do that in China. And Hobby Lobby carries their stuff. They don't have a problem with that. You can make money doing that. It's amazing. Okay, anything goes Friday. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. Allison in Glen Ellen, Illinois. Hey, Allison, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller, but I listen to your program every afternoon.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk to you today about energy suppliers. In Illinois, we can choose our energy supplier now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's nationwide, but anyway, I thought I would like to go with 100% renewable energy,
mm-hmm.
and some of the suppliers have that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I investigated. And unfortunately, because I'm retired and living on a fixed income, I can't afford to do it.
Right, because it costs a few cents more. When we lived in Portland, the PG&E was the only electric supplier, but they buy electricity from different sources. They bought a lot of electricity from the dams, you know, from water power, which is 100% renewable, and then they also buy electricity from power plants. And I think it was like something like 7 cents an hour for a kilowatt hour for electricity if you just bought conventional, but it was like 8.5 or 9 cents if you bought it that was 100% guaranteed green. I paid the extra. I could afford it. But I get your point. If there was a carbon tax, go ahead. Back to you, Allison. You wanted to make a point?
Exactly. And I know that it's no good asking Congress to do anything about that carbon tax because pretty much they're all bought by the oil and gas industry, I believe.
Yeah.
And so I wrote to the president this afternoon and asked if there's anything he can do with his pen. And the thing that I was really wondering about is residential energy credits might not help me too much, but it might help some other people. But under energy credits, I just got my tax organizer today, so I'm looking at all the things that qualify for tax credits. But
those are all things that you, that have to be done by the legislative branch. The Constitution requires all taxation and all spending to begin in the House of Representatives. So the president
can't. Nothing that Obama can do then.
To the best of my knowledge, there isn't. But, you know, I think your original point that if the actual cost of producing electricity with carbon fuels, if these carbon companies, and he pointed this out in his State of the Union speech, you know, why are we giving a $3 or $4 billion a year subsidy to the fossil fuel industry? That if instead of getting a subsidy, they were paying a tax that reflected the true costs to us. I mean, we're spending tens of billions of dollars a year cleaning up storm damage from global warming induced severe weather. We're spending billions and billions, who knows how many billions of dollars, from cancers and asthma and other things caused by fossil fuel burning, all this mercury that's in the water, the neurological deficits and diseases and problems associated with that. If there was a carbon tax, then your choice on your electric bill would, do you want green or do you want fossil fuel? And the fossil fuel would be the more expensive one rather than the green one. And that would be a good thing, I think.
That would be a great thing.
Yeah. And so I think that this is going to be the year, Allison. I really, really do. I think that we're hitting a critical awakening in America. There are these tipping points, these political tipping points, and I predict that by the end of this year, carbon tax is going to be something that is being seriously discussed in Congress. I hope I am right. I'm quite sure I'm going to be right, but we'll see. Allison, thank you for the call. Thank you for a very thoughtful call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with more of your calls. And be sure to check out free-don.org. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is priceless, writes Willie T. over at the Democratic Underground. Stocks dive. This is a CNBC report that he's quoting. Stocks dive, Dow off 200 points. Why? Walmart stores added to Wall Street's dreary view. With the discount retail slicing its fourth quarter outlook. Why? Because of the cut in food stamps. Walmart's going to make less money because food stamps got cut. And so Walmart's stock price is dropping, and it's driving down the stock market because the Republicans cut food stamps. The Republicans who are probably largely invested in the stock market. Weren't you guys paying attention when we said that the most powerful form of stimulus for an economy was food stamps? Another one, that was brought to my attention by democraticunderground.com. It's just brilliant. John Franklin Stevens, apparently Ann Coulter, tweeted something about the president being retarded. And, you know, during the State of the Union, if my understanding of the context here of this is correct. And so John Franklin Stevens, the global messenger for the Special Olympics of the state of Virginia, wrote her the following letter, and I will read it intact. It's brilliant, and it's public. Dear Ann Coulter, come on, Ms. Coulter, you aren't dumb, and you aren't shallow, so why are you continually using a word like the R word as an insult? I'm a 30-year-old man with Down syndrome who has struggled with the public's perception that an intellectual disability means that I am dumb and shallow. I am not either of those things. but I do process information more slowly than the rest of you. In fact, it has taken me all day to figure out how to respond to your use of the R word last night. I thought first of asking whether you meant to describe the president as someone who was bullied as a child by people like you, but rose above it to find a way to succeed in life as many of my fellow Special Olympians have. Then I wondered if you meant to describe him as someone who has had to struggle to be thoughtful about everything he says, as everyone else races from one snarky soundbite to the next. Finally, I wondered if you meant to degrade him as someone who is likely to receive bad health care, live in low-grade housing with very little income, and yet still manages to see life as a wonderful gift. Because, Ms. Coulter, that is who we are, and much, much more. After I saw your tweet, I realized you just wanted to belittle the president by linking him to people like me. You like to assume, you assumed that people would understand and accept that being linked to someone like me is an insult, and you assumed you could get away with it and still appear on TV. I have to wonder if you considered other hateful words but recoiled from the backlash. Well, Ms. Coulter, you and society need to learn that being compared to people like me should be considered a badge of honor. No one overcomes more than we do and still loves life so much. Come join us someday at Special Olympics. See if you can walk away with your heart unchanged. And then he signs it, a friend you haven't made yet, John Franklin Stevens, Global Messenger, Special Olympics, Virginia. There you go. John Stevens is a hero. Okay, Bernie Sanders, the State Department has said that the Keystone XL pipeline looks just fine to them. Bernie Sanders just issued this. I just got this in email. The State Department, yeah, and if you've signed up for the Bernie Buzz over at sanders.senate.gov, you got it too. The State Department turns a blind eye to the ugly reality that extracting and refining dirty tar sands oil will spew into our atmosphere more and more of the greenhouse gases that cause global warming. To my mind, global warming is the most serious environmental crisis facing the world, and President Obama should block construction of the Keystone Pipeline. Da-da. Oh, and George Zimmerman said, you know, anybody want to fight me for money? TMZ is reporting that Ali Bomei rapper has accepted the fight. He's going to fight. This is a boxing match being promoted by Damon Feldman. It's scheduled for March 1st. The Game is the name that the rapper goes by. Celebrity rapper to The Game. His actual name is Ali Bomei. And he is 240 pounds and 6'5" and heavily muscled, an African American. And he says, quote, I will beat the blank out of him. I would not be boxing for me. I'd be boxing for the legacy of Trayvon Martin and for his family. I would box him to knock him out, and I would definitely take pleasure in it. It's legal, and I want to show him you can solve your disputes without a weapon. Bingo. Dennis in, I don't know how to pronounce that town in Mississippi. Dennis, how do you say it? Is it Kosciuszko, Dennis? Dennis, are you listening to your telephone? Apparently not. Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana. Hey, Kathy, you want to talk you wanted to speak on behalf of the death penalty?
Yes, because I figured something out today while watching your show. Mm-hmm. I connected all the dots with everything you have discussed about Medicare, food stamps, and the death penalty, and this is my thought on it. I believe in the death penalty because of cases like Gacy and Bundy. But then I got to thinking, these governors, these state representatives, and all these people who won't allow Medicaid, aren't they killing people too?
Yes, they are. There will be tens of thousands of people who will die this year because of 5.5 million people in the red states who are low-income people.
You.
Can't get health insurance.
So let's not rule out the death penalty just yet. I believe in it being done humanely. I don't mean for, you know, just do it because you can get away with doing it. But what I'm saying is that there's a underlying, I can't explain what I know, what I'm trying to tell you.
Is what you're trying to say that the people who are promoting policies that are going to cause tens of thousands of people to die that they themselves should be subject to a humane death penalty?
Thank you.
Okay.
Aren't they
I can't endorse that, Kathy, and I'm sure you understand. But I understand the sentiment. I understand the outrage. I hope for a political death penalty for all these people, that politically their careers are ended. And I suspect that as more and more people realize the game that the Republicans are playing, that they will experience a political death penalty. Thanks, Kat. I realize you're speaking tongue-in-cheek, and I it's brilliant. It was brilliant. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. How you doing, Armin?
Hey, I'm doing good. You know, before I leave this earth, my wish of all wishes is to spend about 3 or 4 hours with you. We can go fishing. We can sit in a mall with other people around. I just would really love to, for once, convince myself. Now, respectfully, don't cut me off. If you're smoking too much dope, or, you know, you just need a little mental correction here on some of your philosophical applied points of view.
Okay.
I have a lot of respect.
Let me reassure you, first of all, Armin, I don't qualify for medical marijuana. If I did, I would probably use it, but it's been a lot of years,
well,
so I'm not smoking too much dope, unfortunately.
Anyway, I'd love to spend, you know, I think you, I just want to believe in my heart, and I do, and some days I question my belief.
Okay, so what is it you want to disagree with me about? Let's just get right to it.
Well, my thing is, if you don't cut me off, the biggest problems, and, you know, the two parties, there are some good people in the Democratic side, and believe it or not, I think there are some good people that really have principles. Not a lot, I agree, on the Republican side.
I agree with you.
But the overwhelming majorities on both sides are just a theater performance I've been watching for the last 40 years.
And I don't disagree with that.
The question is,
what are we going to do about it?
Well,
are we going to complain about it, or are we going to get active and actually do something, join movements, get inside the parties? Which is it going to be for you, Armin?
Well, I've thought about that a lot. Okay, and I can remember. Let me say my point, please.
Sure.
Let me keep talking.
Go for it.
When Clinton was in, and they were way over the top attacking him and Hillary, and Hillary and Bill had a lot of dirt that could be dug up, because I don't think that they were really moral and ethical people most of the time when they were down there in MENA. You can disagree or you can agree, but anyway,
I just don't know. I don't think anybody's gets to be president, you know, being squeaky clean, but who knows? I don't really care.
But anyway, you know, there's some very significant issues that are ensuing, but I look at it like, you know, when the Clintons, when they left office.
Armin, you got 30 seconds to finish your point. We're hitting the break.
Well, Hillary said that it was a right-wing conspiracy. Then once they got out, they were broke, and then they joined that family thing up there. Now they're worth over $250 million.
No, I think it's more like 80 million, but yeah, I get your point.
They're in lockstep with the Bush crime family, so we really should call it the Reagan-Bush-Clinton crime family, because that's how powerful it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we know who they represent. And the thing is, the best case against giving people, poor people, everything free is the rich. It doesn't work for them. They want more and more and more and more.
That's an argument that almost, in a kind of bizarre inside-out way, makes a little bit of sense. Armin, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Armin never ceases to impress me with his intellect. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Don in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Don, thanks for watching. What's up?
Thank you. You know, I was thinking about your net neutrality deal, and I just thought I'd bring up, I recently was looking into a virtual privacy network, and I actually set my router up so that everything gets diverted through basically a proxy, which is in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
So the only IP that is ever seen is through the Netherlands.
Right.
You can actually set up a router to do that.
Yep.
And the only thing that, unless the ISP starts to actually spy on, directly.
Let me tell you a first-person story, Don. What you're talking about is VPN, virtual private network. And I've had a VPN. I've subscribed to a VPN service for 5 years, at least, and for a long time. And the same one. And they're really it's one of the better ones. And they've got servers all over the world. And starting about 2 months ago, whenever I would log on to my VPN service, whether I was using a server in DC or a server in Miami or a server in Amsterdam, one of my internet carriers, which is my cable company here, would just stop. After about 10 minutes of data, they would just basically cut me off from the internet. And then I've got a second internet connection, which is over a wireless system here in Washington, D.C. And that one, and this, they started at the same time, and this was just a few weeks ago. The one that I've got over the wireless, which I use as my backup because my life depends on having access to the internet. So I've got two internet connections coming into my boat, right? One's wireless, one's my cable system. And that one now, when I go on the VPN network, they cut me off from the internet too. I think the ISPs all over the country are starting to do this. They're auto detecting. And when they detect that you're using a VPN so that they can't do deep packet inspection, they can't see what websites you're visiting, so they can't figure out how to monetize you, they cut you off. Have you had that problem yet?
No, I haven't, but I'm in Iowa, so, you know, maybe... Yeah.
Do you mind my asking which company is your internet service provider?
Well, I'm actually switching, so I may encounter your problem. Right now I'm using Imon Communications, which is a small company where I'm at, and I'm going to be switching to Mediacom, which is a larger company. So now you brought up some fears. They might start...
Yeah, well, two companies that I'm using here in Washington, D.C., which are the only two options that I have, are two of the five largest companies in the United States. And so I'm assuming that all five of the five largest companies in the United States are doing this now, although I might be wrong in that assumption.
They're going to find a way no matter what, then. I was thinking this would be a good way to get around net neutrality, but
no,
perhaps not.
No. What they do is they'll just cut you. My experience has been, and then you find yourself in the weird position of, you know, okay, do I call my ISP and complain about it? And let them know that I'm using a VPN? Well, they already know, but do I become conspicuous? You know, and if they cut me off altogether, then I'm really toast because there's only one company that I can get, you know, cable from right now where I live. And it's like, this is a mess. I mean, you know, Congress should have declared that ISPs are common carriers. And if Congress didn't declare it, the FCC should have declared it, that they're common carriers, and therefore they have to behave like the phone companies and carry your conversations regardless of what you say. But now they're doing the equivalent of listening in on your phone calls and charging you different prices based on who you're talking to and what you say, and whether it's commercial or personal, all that kind of stuff. So, Don, get ready. Thank you very much for the call. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Polly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at all the companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, now Cumulus, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, to Comcast, to Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the other ones around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices Channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Dethicott, and all the folks in our chat room. Hey, how you doing? To Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech supports, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you, and to Will today, filling in, answering the phones. I don't know if he wants his last name on the air, so thank you, Will. Thank you all. It's great to have such a fine team that helps make this program, that keeps me going, you know? I mean, without these folks, there would be no Tom Hartman program. And without you, as I said, thank you for watching. And or thank radio station Steve, for example, listening in on WCPT. Thanks, WCPT, for carrying our show in DeKalb, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I like it when you talk about our corrupted tax policy. The tax status of organizations like not-for-profit and non-profit kind of puzzle me, because Roger Goodell, commissioner of the NFL,
paid $30 million in 2011,
right.
And the NFL is nonprofit. We've got local not-for-profit hospitals that don't pay their property tax, but they have to give money away to the community to be not-for-profit. I suggest that none of these organizations should be able to pay their CEOs more than the President of the United States if they want to avoid paying property tax and paying.
Well, I think a simpler solution, Steve, is to simply start redefining nonprofits. I think it's insane that a business like the NFL is a not-for-profit. Frankly, I didn't know that, and so I'm taking you at your word. But we've got. And I think that we need to tighten up the definitions of not-for-profits, because you've got these 501c3s and 501c4s, nonprofit organizations run by people like Karl Rove, and on the Democratic side there's one as well. I mean, there's these programs where they don't have to disclose their donors. They're basically laundering billionaire money or corporate money, or maybe it's even Saudi money, or who knows? It could be Iranian money, or it could be Chinese money, and running campaign ads and things like that, and calling themselves educational organizations. I think an educational organization has to have a school building and have kids, right? Or students, not buy TV ads to say Obamacare is good or bad. We really need to overhaul our tax code. And I also think that churches in the United States, we're seeing all this political activity being conducted by churches. And I'm all in favor of monasteries being not-for-profit and being exempted from taxes, because I think that monasteries actually play epistemology, every one of us, by the way that we conduct ourselves and we think and we act, is affecting all of us. And I think that people who live monastically, monks and nuns, are actually a light. I think that they're a positive impact in the world, and they have no way of making money. And so they would be put out of business if they had to pay property taxes. So I'd give them nonprofit status, but that's it. Every other church in this country, churches used to have to pay taxes. This is a relatively recent thing. It came about the middle of the 20th century. Nonprofit status for churches. Let's let them pay property tax, and if they want to play politics, let them do it. The right-wing ones are already doing it anyway. But I think that we just need a complete overhaul of our tax policy from top to bottom. Steve, thanks for the call. Thanks for bringing up a topic that is close to my heart. Anna Lisa in Carson City, Nevada, watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, my God. Hi, Tom. Long time no talk to.
Thank you.
I want to applaud you for yesterday's show with Alan Grayson. It was just a breath of fresh air. It was wonderful. It was very uplifting. The other thing I want, please have him on more often.
Sure. Okay, thank you. Thank you for the feedback.
Oh, absolutely. And then also I wanted to bring up, there is a group out there called Economic Policy Research, and they just stated yesterday that since 1968, if salaries had kept up with productivity, the minimum hourly wage would be $21.72 an hour. And the last thing I would love to do, and I hope you don't cut me off, but to bring this to the audience's attention, if they want to talk to the White House, to dial 212-456-1111,
right.
Standard Eastern Standard Time, 9 to 5. And please say something about our trade representatives, that the president should have a second look at them, because that's the bottom of all of this.
I'm with you, Annalisa. Let me slightly recalibrate that, if I may. That is the White House comment line, and I'm all in favor of letting the White House know. But the big battle is going to be in the House of Representatives. And I had a long conversation about this last night on the TV show, and with Lori Wallach from Global Trade Watch, Citizens Trade Watch. And it's the concern, because the president in April is going to Asia, and this is the Southern Hemisphere Asian countries that we're signing a trade deal with. So Southern Hemisphere, that's SH, Asian A, Free Trade Agreement, FTA. So this is SHAFTA that he's promoting. And a tip of the hat to, I think it was Jacob who called earlier and proposed that as the acronym when Bernie Sanders was on, that SHAFTA, also known as the TPP, which would give us NAFTA, CAFTA, and SHAFTA, the president wants, when he goes to Asia, to Southern Hemisphere Asia, he wants to be able to hand the trade deal to them and say, okay, Congress has given, I have fast-track authority, so we can all sign this thing, and I'll just be able to get it through. And the House of Representatives is where the battle's going to be. So you need to call your member of the House, because in the Senate, Harry Reid's already said, I'm not all happy with this. But it might slip through if it makes it through the House. So call your member of the House of Representatives and say no to SHAFTA, no to the TPP, no to Fast Track Authority. Annalisa, brilliant call. Thank you so much. And thank you for your activism, and thank you for watching the program. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, and don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.